Greetings and salutations, Darklings. We are Chell and Tori, and welcome to Vampires Ruined My Life. Tonight, we're going to discuss the 1992 comedy horror film Buffy the Vampire Slayer and its novelization written by Richie Tankersley Cusick.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer was directed by Fran Rebel Kuzui and written by Joss Whedon, who is reportedly not entirely happy with the final version of how the film turned out. We will discuss that in a little bit. It was released in theaters on July 31st, 1992. It follows the story of Valley Girl cheerleader Buffy, who learns she's the chosen one, destined to fight and defeat vampires. And it's got a pretty all-star cast. Like, I had not seen the movie in a very long time, and I was really impressed with how many people I recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of impressive. Buffy is played by Christy Swanson. She played Erica in the short-lived series Early Edition, which I remember really liking. Mm-hmm. I don't remember a lot about it. I just remember it was about this guy who would like get the newspaper early and had to like prevent tragedies. Mm-hmm. But I remember I really enjoyed it. I think it only lasts like a season.
No, it was a few seasons. And it also it had that cute kitty.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ron Livingston?
Yeah. Yeah, I did really like that show when it was on.
And Fisher Stevens, I think, was his pal.
Okay.
My mom and I were really into it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching it, and I just remember really digging it when it was on every week, and then it just kind of stopped being on, and I stopped thinking about it, but it was good. She also plays Marlo, who's Carlton's girlfriend and eventual wife, in 6 episodes of Psych, starting with their vampire episode, This Episode Sucks, where she's working as a bartender. Her role there was obviously meant to be kind of a cameo because she had obviously played Buffy and they had a lot of vampire references in the episode. But the character ended up going on to become Carlton's girlfriend. And like I said, they get married. And so she is in more episodes down the road, which I thought was really cool, especially because her brother turned out to be the vampire killer and she was helping him a little bit. But it was because he was sick and didn't have health insurance and needed blood transfusions because capitalism is awful. And she goes to jail for a while and Carlton visits her in jail and then she gets out and they get married. So yay, happy ending.
Aw. So as a child, I knew her best as Jessie from Mannequin 2 on the Move, which I was like obsessed with as a kid. But she first came to prominence as Kathy Dullinger in the film adaptation of Flowers in the Attic, based on the V.C. Andrews novel. Mm-hmm. I always thought when I was a kid that she would have been the perfect Harley Quinn of her time.
She would have been
the only one who could have pulled it off if they had live action Harley Quinn.
Yeah, totally. She would have been good.
Like if they had put her in like Batman Forever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Donald Sutherland as Merrick. This is our third time with a Donald Sutherland related property.
Uh-huh. I know.
I'm looking forward to like a Donald Sutherland placement on a bingo card that I might make for this podcast. Oh, yeah. Donald Sutherland / Rutger Hauer.
Yeah, he does pop up a lot.
So he played President Snow in the Hunger Games trilogy. He's had a long and storied career, most notably starting with MASH, the motion picture, where he originated the role of Hawkeye Pierce. His filmography includes Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Dirty Dozen, and The Pillars of Earth. He was also added to the National Security Agency Watchlight between 1971 and 1973, at the request of the CIA because of his anti-war activities. According to unreliable narrator and overall dickbag, Joss Whedon, Sutherland would rewrite some of his Merrick lines, which infuriated Whedon and his precious ego, so that he has henceforth spoken ill of an actor I cannot otherwise find evidence of ever behaving badly on set. And trust me, I looked for a couple of days. So take that one as you will.
I feel like Whedon was really precious about his script for this one, which is funny because by all accounts, it wasn't really changed that much. So
don't get me started.
We're going to talk about it later. Yeah, there's a couple articles I read about it. I just think it's funny because like, yeah, anyway.
So then we have Luke Perry as Pike. So I want to go on record saying that I prematurely judged Luke Perry as a child because he was guilty by association with Beverly Hills 90210, which I loathed when I was a kid. But Luke was a really funny actor, and I wish he had been given more comedic roles in his life. He did have a career outside of the teen soap opera, most notably on the HBO show Oz, the Broadway revival of Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was his last role before he tragically died of a stroke at the age of 52.
Yeah, I read somewhere that he really wanted this role because he wanted to kind of branch out and do some comedic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He also looks so much like James Marsters in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of freaked me out a couple times because he would like walk in and I'd be like, wait, okay, no, that's not Spike. But it's funny because his name is also Pike. And so it mm-hmm. sounds like Spike. And then he looks like James Marsters. Yeah. And you're just like, what? Little confusing for, I mean, not, it was just a little, you know, funny. I thought it was amusing. And then there's Rutger Hauer as Lothos. Rutger Hauer is no stranger to the show, as he would go on to be the vampire antiques dealer Kurt Barlow in Salem's Lot 2004, which we covered on this podcast, and you can listen to us rant about that adaptation in a different episode. He was also reunited with Donald Sutherland in that movie, so they were both in that. You probably know him from his roles in Blade Runner, Lady Hawk, True Blood, Batman Begins, and quite a few features wherein he starred as the Ancient One himself, Count Dracula.
And then we have Paul Reubens as Amalyn, which late Gen Zer and elder millennials know Paul Reubens best as Pee-wee Herman. He's had lots of roles since then. He's appeared on shows like Murphy Brown and in films like Blow. So he's just an overall notable guy.
Yeah, he looked so familiar. I could not figure out who he was. And then when I looked it up, I was like, oh, because he's got like the long hair and the makeup and, you know, it just didn't quite click.
Yeah,
and
then sure.
Oh, of course. Okay.
We have notable supporting cast, David Arquette as Benny, plus his sister, Alexis Arquette, as the vampire DJ at the end. Stephen Root as Principal Gary Murray. Stephen Root is both face, but also a voice actor. I believe he plays Bill Dautrey on King of the Hill.
Yeah, he's in so much stuff. Like, he's one of those people that you will recognize from something because he has been in just millions of things.
And we also have Hilary Swank as Kimberly, and uncredited roles to Ricky Lake, Ben Affleck, and Seth Green, who would go on to play beloved werewolf Oz in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV show.
Yes.
I don't actually know that if he was a beloved werewolf, but
I think so. I think people generally like him a lot.
I think so, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty popular character. He's really fun. And Seth Green is just such a good actor that he brings so much to the role. Like, he's really intriguing, I feel like. And I love Oz. I think Oz is a sweetheart.
So that's like kind of where I ended up. Like there's like a small gap of seasons that I haven't seen of Buffy. And that's like right at the Oz era. Like Oz and what's the little military little pisher?
Riley? Oh, season four, Riley. Yeah. Season four is where, I mean, we will have episodes about the Buffy television show, but like, in my opinion, season four is where it starts going downhill. And then after like, I don't know, midway season five, it just starts careening down that path and doesn't ever really come back. And there are some solid episodes later in the series, but.
Yeah, I watched the show backwards. I started watching it in season five.
Yeah, season five is kind of a mess. Season six is a mess. Season seven is, I don't even know what they were doing in season seven. I have a lot of really strong opinions about the writing in season seven. So,
yeah, so I started watching it like as it was airing in season five because of Michelle Trachtenberg. Like, she was the only thing that like got me to watch it. And then I just ended up, you know, finishing it. And then a decade and a half later, I then was like, oh, I should try this from the beginning. Like, what's his face doesn't annoy me as much anymore. So I'm going to go ahead and, you know, start watching this and I can just, you know, whatever, ignore the parts with him. But what's his face is not Joss Whedon. It's Angel, that guy.
Oh, I love.
I don't like him.
See, I love Angel. I think Buffy and Angel are so great together. I
don't like the actor, David
Boreanaz. Yeah.
So
I don't have a problem with him, although I don't love him as a person. I don't know anything about him, but I thought as Angel, he was great.
So then I started watching it and I was like, okay, whatever. And then, yeah, I got to kind of like right when Oz was introduced and then, I don't know, I just fell off the, you know.
Yeah.
You just stop watching things. That's all.
Yeah. Oh, it happens to me all the time. And then like the worst thing for me is like if I stop watching and then I try and go back, but I can't remember where I watched to, but I don't want to rewatch.
Yep.
So then I just never get back to it because I can't remember where I left off, but I don't want to have to rewatch the whole thing to like get to that point.
Thankfully for me, because I know the end game anyway, Buffy is not one of those shows where I will ever have to worry about that. I'm like, I already know where this goes.
Yeah. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, totally fine. Buffy's one of my favorite things. I love it a lot, but it has a lot of problems too. So
see, and Buffy is one of my least favorite vampire properties. So I find that to be very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I watched
that,
it.
We have that juxtaposition. I think it's good. It's healthy. It's a healthy juxtaposition.
It is. It is. And I watched it in high school. I was super into it. You know, I loved all vampire stuff. So I thought it was cool.
But here we are at the genesis of it all. So
the movie, which I did see in the 90s at some point, I had already seen at least a season or two of the TV show. So the movie was kind of like, it was one of those things where it was like, oh, like it was fun, but like you already have these preconceived notions of like who the characters are. And then you watch. Yeah. And so then you watch the movie and you're like, oh, because it's obviously different. And so that's fine. Like I didn't hate it. I didn't dislike it. It was just kind of jarring because you have all these ideas of who the characters are. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, interesting, but it does make sense as like an origin story for her too. So it works either way, really.
I had the opposite. So I saw this film the second it came on VHS because my parents would not take me to see it in the theater.
You were what, like 10?
10. I was 10.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my God, Dad, take me to see the vampire film. And he's like, no. He's like, no, your mom said no. Like he would have taken me to see it, but my mom kept saying no. For a very specific reason, and it had nothing to do really with this film. It really had to do with being scarred by Dracula 1992, which we will talk about later.
That's so funny, because like I was that way with Interview with the Vampire. My mom would not let me see it in theaters, but when it came out on video, she did rent it, and we did get to watch it as a family, so that was cool. And I'd already read the book and stuff, but like I wasn't allowed to go see it. This movie I didn't see till much later.
I saw this film the minute it came on VHS, and I loved it immediately. And then years down the line, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV show debuted, and I was like, who are these people? This is not the lore. This is not what I knew. I do not like this. And I do not like any of these people and their wooden acting. I can't take it. Goodbye. So so I was like, nope, I wrote it off immediately, like the TV show, because I was such a fan of the film. But
that's funny.
I hadn't seen the film, though, in many years. Not like since I was a little kid, but, you know, at least like a good 20 years, I would say. So this was my first viewing, at least like well into adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely haven't watched it since the first time I watched it, so it had been a while. So we're just going to go over a short summary of the movie. And it opens with Buffy, who is a cheerleader at Henry High School in Los Angeles. We see that she's a carefree, popular girl whose main concerns are shopping and spending time with her snooty friends, who all seem to be pretty rich and well off. And also her boyfriend, Jeffrey. While she's at school one day, she's approached by a man who calls himself Merrick. He tells her that she's the Slayer, which is the chosen one who's destined to kill vampires. And he's a Watcher whose duty is to guide and train her. She initially rebukes his claims because she's just like, what? That's insane. And it, I mean, it does sound pretty ridiculous to have some guy like approach you and be like, hey, you're destined to fight vampires. I mean, in high school, if someone had done that to me, I would have been like, yes, I knew it. Same. But also, you know, once the shock wore off, I'd be like, that doesn't sound real. So yeah, but she obviously never wanted anything to do with that stuff, so she's like, nope, you're wrong. But eventually she's convinced that he's telling the truth when he's able to describe a recurring dream of hers in detail. In addition, Buffy keeps exhibiting these uncanny abilities that she had never had before, including heightened agility, senses, and endurance. And she repeatedly tries Merrick's patience with her frivolous nature, her indifference to slaying, and her, you know, sarcastic, sharp-tongued remarks. After several successful outings hunting vampires, Buffy is drawn into a conflict with Lothos, a local vampire king, and his acolyte, Amulet. Two young men, Pike and his best friend Benny, who resented Buffy and her friends due to differing social circles, they have a little conflict at a restaurant bar bowling alley thing.
And the movie theater.
Yeah, they have a couple different conflicts, actually. Yeah. And they're out drinking when they're attacked by Amelin. Benny is turned, but Pike is saved by Merrick. That scene was really fun, too, because he, like, finds him passed out in the road, and he's like, you can't sleep here. It's just good.
He's like, it's unsafe for you, my friend. He's like, all right.
Yeah, so he gets him home safe. As a vampire, Benny visits Pike and tries to get him to join him. Later, when Pike and his bosses are discussing Benny, because I guess he hasn't shown up for work, Pike tells him that if he sees him, he should run. Meanwhile, a studious girl from Buffy's class, Cassandra, is abducted one night by Amelin and sacrificed to Lothos. Her disappearance and some of the strange happenings around town are dismissed by Buffy's clique because they don't really care about local events and it doesn't seem to affect them. So it's not like a huge deal. And a lot of people don't really realize that something bigger is happening, but their group specifically just is pretty apathetic about it.
When Pike realizes there is something wrong with Benny and he is no longer safe, he decides to skip town. His plan is thwarted, however, when he encounters Amelin and his tribe of vampires. Amelin hitches a ride on the hood of Pike's van, which crashes into a tree just before Amelin loses an arm. Buffy and Merrick arrive to rescue Pike, and Amelin flees the flight and runs back to Lothos. After this encounter, Buffy and Pike start a reluctant friendship, and Pike becomes invested in fighting the undead alongside her.
Mm-hmm.
During a basketball game, Buffy realizes that Gruller, one of the players and a friend of her boyfriend Jeffrey, is a vampire. After a quick chase to a storage yard, which I will absolutely talk about weird location logic in this film, Buffy finally confronts Lothos shortly after she and Pike take down his gang. Lothos puts Buffy in a hypnotic trance, which is broken due to Merrick's intervention. However, Lothos turns on Merrick and stabs him with the stake that Merrick attempted to use on him. Lothos leaves, saying that Buffy is not ready for her final confrontation with him. As Merrick dies, he tells Buffy to do things her own way rather than live by the rules of others, while adding for her to remember about the music. Because of her new life, responsibilities, and heartbreak, Buffy becomes a little traumatized and starts skirting her Slayer duties. When she arrives at school, she attempts to explain everything to her friends, but they refuse to understand her as they are more concerned with their upcoming school dance, and Buffy falls out with them as she realizes she is outgrowing their immature, selfish behavior. At the senior dance, Buffy tries to patch things up with her friends, but they turn against her, and she is dismayed to find that besides dumping her by leaving a message on her answering machine...
Oh, I know, and how just like...
That's one of my favorite lines. You broke up with my machine?
I know, it's so great.
It's like 10 plus years before dumping by text would become a thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, Jeffrey also had the audacity to go to the dance with her friend, Jennifer.
Ugh,
and that's
gross.
Bad on you, Jennifer, too.
I know. Come on, girl. Come on.
Yeah. As a result, while the other students are dancing to a slow song on the dance floor, Buffy is all by herself without a dance partner. However, Pike shows up.
Yay.
Yay. And as they start to dance and even kind of, you know, have a little smooch, Lothos decides to lead the remainder of his minions to the school and attacks the students and the teachers who are present as chaperones.
So Buffy confronts the vampires outside while Pike fights vampire Benny inside, along with the other vampires who are flooding into the gym. After overpowering the vampires, she confronts Lothos inside the school and she kills Amelin. Lothos hypnotizes Buffy again, and when the dance music stops, she remembers Merrick's words and snaps out of the trance, ready to defend herself. Lothos ignites her cross, but she uses hairspray to create a makeshift flamethrower and burns him before escaping back to the gym. Buffy sees everyone recover from the attack, but Lothos emerges again, getting into another fight with Buffy, who's then able to stake him and kill him for good, presumably, we hope. As all of the survivors leave, Buffy and Pike decide to finish their dance. Then the two of them leave on a motorcycle, and we see a news crew interviewing students and the principal about the attack. And that's how the movie ends.
Ta-da.
Yeah. So, like I said, I hadn't seen this movie since the first time I watched it, and I was so confused because the gym didn't burn down, and I kept waiting for them to burn down the gym to kill all the vampires inside. I was super shocked because... in the show, Buffy, there's this joke about how she burned down the gym at her previous school. Like, she's in trouble with the principal And he's like, you burned down the gym. And she's like, yeah, because it was full of vampires. Asbestos. It was full of asbestos. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I've always loved that little joke. And I had assumed that that joke was a reference to the movie on, you know, rewatches of Buffy, because I hadn't seen the movie in so long. I just kind of thought that was how the movie probably ended, because I remembered the vampires in the gym. So I was like, oh, obviously. But yeah, did not happen in the movie. Obviously, the show is kind of continuing from the movie. The idea is that her parents got divorced, and so her mom, Joyce, moves her to Sunnydale, and that's where the show kind of picks up.
Yeah, so I was surprised that the novelization did not even end with the burning down of the gym. Like, Butt Whedon made such a huge stink about how they ruined his script, but if the novelization is based on the script, which it actually is, because that's what the author maintains, that was never part of it. But I do like the burning down of the gym as key lore of TV version Buffy. So I thought that would have been hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, it is something that happens in the show. Apparently, it must happen after whatever the events of the movie, because that is part of why her mom moves her to Sunnydale after the divorce, because she gets kicked out of school for setting the gym on fire.
Oh, no, and I'm not doubting the canon. Like, I know. That. I like that as canon. Like, I think that's very clever. So I had assumed that that was in Whedon's original script.
Oh, gotcha.
And it wasn't.
Nope.
Like, it just absolutely wasn't.
No, it was just something they came up with for the show later, which makes sense. But yeah, not in the movie. However, the best line in the movie is when Buffy is like lamenting that she doesn't want to be a Slayer. She wants to be a normal teenager. And she says, all I want to do is graduate from high school, go to Europe, marry Christian Slater, and die. I just think that's such a great line, especially because I have had just like a lifelong crush on Christian Slater. I think he's so great.
Haven't we all?
I'm just like a card-carrying member of the Christian Slater fan club. I think he's fantastic. I've always thought he was really great. And then, of course, he plays my guy in Interview with the Vampire, the movie. And I think he did an exceptional job. The role was supposed to go to River Phoenix, and then he passed away, unfortunately. And I don't know. I think Christian Slater nails it, honestly. Like, I think he does such a fantastic. He's got the mannerisms. He's got the attitude. Like, he really does embody, like, how I picture Daniel Malloy in a lot of ways. So I think he rocked it. But then also, he's just done so many fun things. He was in this really obscure sitcom on Amazon Prime, like, in 2008 or something, that was like, it was called Breaking In, and it was about this group of security experts who like test people's security systems by breaking into them or something. And I just remember thinking that was the funnest thing. And he just seems like a cool dude. Like, he just seems like a cool dude, and I just adore him. So yeah, I loved that line a lot. And I was like, yeah, you know, same.
same. I know. As a 10-year-old, I related very hard to that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's funny is originally in the script, it was supposed to be Charlie Sheen, which no. Obviously, that's before we knew Charlie Sheen was Charlie Sheen. But I do think it's funny that Joss Whedon picked him, because it just shows how these people seem to like.
It still says Christian Slater in the novelization, which is based on his script.
Yeah, but according, the script originally had Charlie Sheen in it instead of Christian Slater. That was who he wanted it to be. But he was a little older. It didn't quite fit, because Christian Slater was still really young in 92. And so I feel like that
Charlie
was probably...
Charlie Sheen was still happening at that time, but he was getting into trouble more.
Like, well, yeah, I'm not saying he was... We knew he was the guy he would become. I'm just saying, I think it's just ironic that was who Joss Whedon had chosen for that line. But I like that they changed it. I think it fits better.
Well, it must have been his change.
I don't know. A couple of the articles I read said that was one of the things that Whedon was upset about.
Weird. So some of my favorite lines are, well, you broke up with my machine. Like, just the indignation of that line. And then when Lothos just goes, kill him a lot. Oh, no. It wasn't Lothos. It was Amalyn. Amalyn has like a lot of really good lines. But when he just like glares at someone, he's just like, kill him a lot.
Yeah, it was funny.
I think that was Amalyn. I don't know if it was him or Lothos, but him and Lothos like have this insane kind of like campy, weird old married couple vibe, which I really, really appreciate.
Yeah, like, no, they do.
They do. And they like, and like, even like their hair and their makeup and their outfits and stuff, just very like, this is an old like vampire married couple who have been like through the ages together and, you know, just terrorizing different communities throughout the world. So They're very fun, and they're very fun to like normally, like, I'm a fan of the vampire, right? Like,
sure.
I want to root for the vampire. But in Buffy, you're supposed to root for Buffy. And I don't mind rooting for Buffy, but I do love the joy that these two idiots kind of bring to, like, vampirism. Like, I don't feel threatened by Lothos as an adult. Maybe as a child I did. I don't know. I don't remember ever finding him too scary. I thought his clothes and his makeup were a little scary.
Okay.
You know? Especially since, because he looks like such a dandy, like gentlemanly dandy kind of looking, almost like puppet-like, you know, like kind of like marionette-ish with like the white face and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved Amalyn's look because he looked very punky, you know, by the time he's in 1992 LA.
So, yeah.
So yeah, those two were hilarious. And normally, like, I can't, like, I don't do animal death, neither does Tori and stuff, but I do find it hilarious. There's like, here's a little snack. And he just like has like this little kitten in his hand. And he's like petting it and everything.
I know. Like, well, you don't see him do anything to the kitten, so I think it makes it easier because you're just
exactly. Yeah. You're just like, okay, sure. Sure, Jan. Like, you're like, all right, whatever.
Once upon a time, a trio of bards, the narrators three, were called upon to unite the realms with an episode-by-episode deep-dive commentary on the fairytale-laden soap opera, Once Upon a Time.
Tune in for weekly retrospect sprinkled with judgmental fondness and hysterical disappointment as the narrators three laugh, throw shade, and have the occasional emotional breakdown.
If you find tales of costuming, character takedowns, and plot devices that come with a price utterly charming, the Narrators 3 invite you to join them for Once Upon a Rewatch, available on all major platforms where podcasts can be found.
So, as someone who's lived in Los Angeles since 1994, so 2 years after this film debuted, I just kind of wanted to go over some of the locations that were shown in this film. So the girls at the beginning, they decided to like go to the cinema. They say that they're going to go to the Westside Pavilion Cinemas, which is located on West Pico. So that's Mid-City West. It was opened in 1985. And funnily enough, this is where a lot of like art house movies were shown. So not exactly Buffy and her friends' go-to place.
Mm-hmm.
But that's funny that they would end up going there. But the film itself shows the exterior of the Hollywood Galaxy, which opened in late 1991. So very interesting. So they must have filmed it like right as it opened. I have distinct memories of like using the restroom while waiting for like one of my clubs that I would frequent to open or something. I don't know. I remember like being at the Galaxy and being like, I have to use the bathroom. I have to go there. So I don't know if I've ever seen any movies there. I probably did, but it closed. It closed years and years ago, which is sad because it was a pretty cool movie theater. So in that same scene where Jeffrey goes to kind of check on Buffy and her friends and stuff with the car, and he's got his two basketball buddies with him, one of them leaves to like go walk home, presumably. And they show him cutting through a park, which is actually Griffith Park, because that merry-go-round in the background that we see Amalyn on is still there. But it's like, that's 6 miles away from it's just like, but yeah, as a kid, I didn't recognize that as being Pee Wee Herman because I was a child and, you know, I just assume someone looked one way. Like the wonders of magic and makeup. But that's such a great shot of him like on the merry-go-round.
Yeah, it is.
So where I have like a real point of contention is when Gruller comes back. He is a vampire when we next see him, and he's playing in the basketball game, and Buffy realizes he's a vampire and she chases after him, and she steals like a motorcycle and goes after him, and he ends up running to this storage lot where all these parade floats are, indicating that this is Pasadena or even Sierra Madre, which is further east, which Buffy would never this would never take place like in that area of LA County, I can guarantee you, because it's so far east. So I was just like, what the hell? Because these floats were in full regalia, you know, very obviously. Like they were all had like their roses for the rose parade, like all their flowers, because they are made out of only living things like seeds, vegetation, flowers, etc. And so they only last so long, like a week, you know, at most. So I was just like, absolutely not. Absolutely. This is not Pasadena. But obviously they filmed or something. I was like, why do they have the floats in the back? Is this like the only lot they could get? I don't understand. This is why I was like really hunting for like some sort of behind the scenes filming location, like tell all sort of, you know, like docu video on YouTube, and no one had done it. And I was just like,
too bad.
I want someone to do like a breakdown of all these filming locations. I go, because this is like really, really interesting.
So one thing I did want to just mention is the song that Buffy and Pike first dance to before the vampires break into the dance is Little Heaven by Toad the Wet Sprocket, which is one of my favorite bands of all time. I love them so much. I have seen them live. I have seen Glenn Phillips live. He actually opened for the Wallflowers at like Caesar's Palace or something in like Tahoe in like, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s. And he was like, hey, I'll be on the lobby if anyone wants anything signed or anything. And so like me and my friends just like left the show and hung out with Glenn Phillips for like a half hour in the lobby. And he like signed my Toad the Wet Sprocket CDs. Coil is one of my favorite albums of all time. It's so good. And ironically, I got into Toad the Wet Sprocket because somebody, I think on the Vampire Lestat message board, one of my friends from that time was like, hey, you know, this song really reminds me of Lestat. And it was like Desire. And I was like, oh, wow, it really does. And so I bought the album and then I got really into them. And I freaking love them as a band. I think they're so good and I'm such a nerd. And so when Little Heaven came on, I was like, it's Toad. And I got really, really excited about that. So anyway, I just wanted to share my dorky excitement over this band that I really love.
That's so cool.
They are very 90s, so I can definitely see why they would be in this movie. They're in a lot of 90s movies. They're like in So I Married an Axe Murderer, and like there's just so many movies where their songs pop up and you're like, oh.
Now I'm curious. I'll have to, after we record, I'll go on Spotify and like listen to some of their songs, because I bet I recognize it.
You'll recognize like Brother or Something's Always Wrong, or they had a song on the Friends soundtrack called Good Intentions that was very like, the Friends soundtrack was such a 90s staple of music, so like I'm sure you've heard.
I never watched a single episode of Friends.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm sure you've heard it on the radio.
Oh, I see.
Played on the radio all the time, like, you know, just so they have been all over TV and movies, so you probably will recognize at least a couple, but I really do think they're great.
Awesome. I didn't do a whole lot of like research into like the fashion of this film. I just want to say how perfect it was, though, because it was still a couple of years before the 70s threw up on every ready-to-wear fast fashion rack. Like, there's still some like lingering 80s pop in this fashion, which I appreciate.
It's very early 90s when this was made, so you definitely get a lot of 80s spillover, which I thought was kind of fun.
Yeah, like the rainbow checkered jacket that the friend wears when Buffy flips Andy for grabbing her butt. I think Jennifer, the one that ends up going out with Jeffrey at the end, I think she's wearing it. But it's like, yeah, I was like, oh, I need that rainbow checker jacket. It's so awesome. Her prom dress is friggin' gorgeous. And of course, the yellow leather jacket.
Yeah, that thing's cool.
Yes. So I was just like, oh, yes, this is so awesome. And Alexis Arquette as the vampire DJ looked beautiful. I was just like, oh, I remember as a kid loving the vampire DJ the best. So I was like, that vampire DJ looks amazing. I want to look like that, because I always wanted suspenders. So, and like a cool jaunty hat. Very ducky. Very, very ducky. Very John Cryer looking. I always thought, just some like notes before we move on. I always thought that the fact that Buffy doesn't know anything about the ozone layer, but knows that Pike is a fish, like, was very baffling. Like, I could tell you in 1992, I knew all about the ozone layer because that was a very hot topic to teach children in science classes in elementary school. But I would have never known that Pike was a fish.
I think I did know pike was a fish. I knew about the ozone layer because you're right. Like, if you went to school in the 80s and 90s, like, you definitely got lectured about how we had to, like, save the ozone layer and stop using aerosol hairspray and all that stuff. So, like, drilled into our brains. But I also grew up in a town.
I was just going to say, you grew up in a town, though, where fishing was huge.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there were pike in Lake Tahoe, but I'm sure that I learned about different types of fish and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did know that.
Yeah. Like, I knew trout. That's pretty much what I knew.
Yeah.
That was my river. That was my river / lake fish that I
also the kokanee salmon, which is known in Lake Tahoe, which is ironic because then I moved to Seattle where there's different kinds of salmon. I don't know. I've always been surrounded by salmon for some reason.
I mean, it's a tasty ass fish.
It is. It's very good. It's very, very good.
Very good. And then the fact that pike is genre savvy. I love that for him.
No, I thought it was really good when Benny's like at his window and it's kind of like a Salem's Lot thing. And he's like, come out, come out. And he's like his friend. And I was like,
let me in. I'm hungry.
Yeah. So I thought that was really good.
And Pike's like, oh my God. Cause he lives in like an apartment above the auto body shop that he works at, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees his best friend like floating out there and he's like, no, I'm not going to let you in.
Yeah. And good for him. Good for him. I also thought it was funny when he was like telling his boss, like, he's like, what should I do if I see Benny? Or what should I say to Benny? And he's like, just if you see him, run. Yeah. Don't stick around.
Don't stick around, man.
Not going to end well for you.
And do you have any favorite like parts? Is there a scene or anything that you love the most?
Oh my gosh. I really like when Merrick approaches her in the locker room and she's kind of like, you can't be in here. What are you doing? And I thought that whole conversation was really good. I kind of liked when she, like, there was a little bit of a montage where she was like getting her vampire hunter groove on, and then like she and Merrick are back at Merrick's place and they have kind of like a actual conversation, and you can tell they're actually like bonding and getting closer, and I thought that was really sweet. And I think my favorite scene is kind of when she goes back to her friends and she realizes that she's like, they're like planning something for the dance, and she realizes that like she doesn't, it's not that she doesn't care, but like that stuff is just so vapid and pointless, like it doesn't matter that much. And I kind of liked that shift in her. I thought that was kind of neat too. You can kind of see how being a vampire slayer has sort of changed her and reorganized her priorities a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, my favorite part is Merrick and Buffy bonding. They're like at his little kind of loft, I guess.
Yeah, it's loft like a studio is a good word.
Yeah, like he lives on this at this loft, and they're finally having like this bonding moment. And she asks, like, you know, what are you going to do when you finally, you know, help slay all the vampires? And he was just so sweet because he's like, oh, maybe I'll finally get to go to heaven. Because he doesn't, when he dies, he gets reborn in this world.
Yeah. And so he's always the watcher. Basically, he's always been the, like, watcher in every life.
In every life. And he's like born with memories. And we'll get more into that later. But he's like, oh, maybe I'll get to finally get to go to heaven or be a bootmaker.
Yeah.
And I just thought like that was, it was just so sweet and so charming. And Donald Sutherland, I don't give a fuck what Whedon says. Like, he brought a lot of charm to Merrick and a lot of sweetness to him. And I also love where he finally asks, or no, like, and there, it's, I think it's the same scene where he, you know, she's like, I'm going to be a buyer. And he was like, what does that mean? She's like, I don't know, but it sounds exciting. And so, yeah. And it's true. So like, flash forward, like, I don't, like 8 years later, I was taking a fashion merchandising class in high school and my teacher was a buyer.
Oh, fun.
And I was like, oh my God, like Buffy. And she was like, what? And so like, I explained to her. And so like, I was like, well, what does that mean? So she buys merchandise from manufacturers to sell at the stores. And I was like, oh, that would have been really good for Buffy. You know, I was like, oh, that is it's a real career. And Buffy, I think, would have been excellent at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just thought that whole scene was very, very sweet.
Yeah, it was a very sweet scene. So I looked up a couple articles about just the making of the movie and just people's opinions on it. And I found a really great one in The Atlantic by Soraya Roberts. It's called I Will Always Love the Original Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Although if you click on the article, the actual headline is The Unsung Brilliance of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Maybe they couldn't decide on a title. Either way, we'll link it in the show notes. It's a pretty fascinating article. But she talks a lot about like Joss's bullshit. And Joss basically said, I thought they were fucking up and I thought they should have filmed some of the things I wrote, which is what he told IGN later, and that they should have let him into the process. But like the article says, if you look at the original Buffy script, it's not actually that different from the director's cut. Most of the dialogue is untouched, although Kazooie does make the vampire mythology less elaborate and the heroine's empowerment a little less spelled out. So Buffy's powers are not completely like on the screen. Like we don't get a laundry list of what they are. So Kazooie apparently dropped Whedon's self-serious tone. He referenced Michelangelo's Pieta, for God's sakes, the article says, which I thought was funny. And she dropped some of the rigorous undead world building. So it's not as like, I mean, it's a movie. You can't go that deep into it really, right? Like you don't have that much time. The director characterized her take as lighter and funnier and less menacing. Apparently even Fox, who was producing the movie, wanted Buffy to be scarier, but Kazooie wanted to keep it appropriate for 12-year-old girls, which I think was probably the right move for this movie. Like, it didn't need to be full-on horror. I think it works as, like, a campy vampire movie, and I don't know. I think Whedon just likes to complain whenever he's not in charge of things.
So this is the perfect segue to the novelization. Author Richie Tankersley-Cusick has written more than 25 novels since her first, Evil on the Bayou, published in 1984. She has also contributed to the Buffy the Vampire Slayer book series with the novelization of the 1992 film, which we're going to discuss shortly, and the first two episodes collected under the title of The Harvest from screenplays by Joss Whedon and The Angel Chronicles, Volume 2. So I had assumed that this novelization would have varied drastically from the script, as Whedon took every opportunity to bemoan the ruination of his revolutionary storytelling. Not only is this nearly 90% identical to what we see in the film, it is merely a script in full sentences, which is the most tragic of film novelization types.
Ugh. Yeah, oh God, I don't even read film novelizations. Like, I'll read a book of a movie if it's based on the book, but if the book is just like the novelization of the film, no thanks. No. I'm good.
I collect film novelizations because I love them so much, generally speaking, and they add, more often than not, they add a lot to it, but this is not one of those times. It is it is literally just a script in full sentences form. And before anyone comes for me to say that perhaps this book was adapted from the alleged bastardization script, it takes great pains to state clearly that it is, quote, based on the screenplay by Joss Whedon. So here are a few scenes I highlighted as either an elaboration or a difference between the final film and the script. We have Buffy and Merrick playing video games, although Cusick calls them computer games such as Game Boy and Super Mario Brothers, which I found endlessly hilarious. Because I was like, I don't know the game Game Boy. What it tell me about this Game Boy game that you are playing on your computer?
Yeah, totally.
It was just like the most boomer thing I've ever fucking read in my life. Merrick states Dracula and Jack the Ripper are one in the same vampire, which I does believe goes on to be canon in at least like the comic books adaptation of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Maybe. I don't know. I know that there is a Dracula episode of Buffy, which is one of the really good season 5 Buffy episodes. I will say Buffy versus Dracula is very solid.
Buffy goes into a church to have a six-pack of Perrier water blessed by the
priest. Oh, nice. I like the Perrier. That's cute.
I love it. It was so, so cute. I was like, oh, that's adorable.
And that feels very Whedon to me. Like, that does feel like a Whedonism.
It does, but also that's also very Lost Boys.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah.
But no, that's very cute. So in the original script, Cassandra does die and she never becomes a vampire. But we do see her as a vampire in the background of the senior dance climax scene because she's wearing the yellow leather jacket that Buffy loaned her. So, okay, get this. It is clearly stated in this script-turned-novel, quote, outside of Pike's first floor window. Meaning that bitchin' homage to Salem's Lot was purely the director's genius and not Joss's.
Yeah.
Okay, now here we have, I would say, the bulk of the difference right here, which is when it comes to Merrick. When Merrick loses his patience with Buffy, he states that he has trained 5 previous slayers only to watch all of them be murdered. Merrick overall is less dignified and kind of more prattish in his characterization. We get some info about the Watchers, namely that they are based out of Hampshire near Stonehenge. Watchers are comprised of a few families who have come from a long line of Watchers and trains their children to be Watchers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Merrick dies differently in the book. In the original script, he pulls a gun on Lothos as a means of distraction so Pike and Buffy can escape. And before Lothos can turn him into a vampire to use against Buffy, Merrick turns the gun on himself and commits suicide.
Mm.
All of these original Merrick lore are made TV-verse canon with the publication of the 1999 comic Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Origins, which is based on the original screenplay. In a 1999 interview, Butt Whedon said, "The original comic, though I have issues with it, can pretty much be accepted as canonical. They did a cool job of combining the movie script, the script, with the series. That was nice. And using the series, Merrick, and not a certain other thespian who shall remain hated. Ugh. Please go choke on a chicken bone, you absolute infected zit of a human being." The film, by contrast, places Merrick as either hundreds of years old or reincarnating with his memories intact, training reincarnations of Buffy as the Slayer. The reincarnation aspect is also present in the book for Buffy, but not necessarily Merrick. It's like a hereditary position, you know, passed
yeah.
down through
well,
lineage.
And in the now, show, it's...
That's what I was about to ask you. What is it in the show with Giles?
So in the show, there's like a council of Watchers, and mm-hmm. How you become a Watcher seems to vary. It doesn't seem to be a destiny thing necessarily. We know Giles was a bit of a bad boy when he was younger, but I can't remember if he was like supposed to be a Watcher or if like he became one later. But it is like a whole group of people, and they all like train prospective slayers, because there's not just one, there's one active slayer. And when that slayer dies, another slayer becomes active and they have to figure out which one it is. But there's like a number of potentials. How that's handled can be different. But like for Kendra, like she's just raised as a slayer her entire life. And so like she knows exactly what she is. Whereas obviously Buffy doesn't know until she is a slayer and someone has to come track her down and be like, you're supposed to kill vampires. And she's like, what? That's crazy. I'm a cheerleader. And I don't believe in vampires, but obviously that doesn't last very long. So, yeah. But the council is like, so they end up becoming kind of a villain in the series, and they're kind of useless in a lot of ways. They're not super great. They tend to cause more problems than they solve for the most mm-hmm. part. Although Giles is very, I love Giles. Giles is amazing. So
Giles is very sweet.
And I do love Wesley Wyndham Price as well. Even though he starts as kind of a dick. We all love Wesley though.
Another change that we see is that Lotho's secret lair is under the high school gym, and he sleeps in a pool of blood, which I'm like, okay, but wouldn't that congeal? Like, do you have to add anticoagulants to it? Like, to
I mean, that's
it, like,
it's common vampire imagery, though. I feel like we see that
I
a lot.
No, but I'm just like,
we even saw it and let the right one in. So, and I don't even know where that blood came from. I'm not even clear on that. So
yeah, true.
It happens.
Anyway, Buffy and Amelin fall into the pool from the gym above during their fight. Speaking of which, Amelin is not funny at all, and the campy gay aspect between him and Lothos is not there, so boop. Like, they're pretty boring. The ending. So this is where people expect me to mention the burning of the gym of Henry High. As we established, nope, didn't happen. Buffy and Lothos take their fight into the hallway outside of the gym, and Buffy ends up staking Lothos with a number two pencil. No
nice.
Fire.
Resourceful. I like that.
And that's exactly what he said. He was all like, Merrick was right. You are resourceful. Die.
good. Yeah.
And then the script originally ends with Buffy and Pike going off vampire hunting in an unnamed location. And that's it.
Nice.
Yeah. So how do you think that this film holds up as its own entity, like unrelated to the show?
No, I think it's good. I don't think it has to be related to the show. I mean, it is obviously related to the show, but if you just take it as its own thing, like, I think it's just a really fun movie. It's entertaining. You know, I love the idea of a Valley girl who become something more. I feel like that was a real 90s thing. We had like Clueless, and I know a little bit later we had Legally Blonde. Like, there's definitely that trope of like the blonde girl who only cares about clothes and dating, who ends up becoming something bigger or whatever. I don't know. I feel like that's super 90s. Yeah, I mean, I think it's super fun. It's entertaining. It's hilarious. It's really well done. The characters are really relatable and fun. And yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I think it holds up really well.
Yeah, same. There's not too much where I would say, ooh, like, there wasn't anything that made me, like, really wince and go, ooh, that did not age well, you know?
Like, yeah,
there's nothing that's jumping out at me. Like, to me, it's a pretty inoffensive film.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot of times when you go back and you watch some of those 90 things, you're just like, ooh, yeah, oh, I can't believe, like, they're saying that, or like, ooh, that didn't age well. So yeah, no, I didn't feel like that at all. There was nothing in there. It does have a really fun, like, late 80s, early 90s aesthetic, and like the mall aesthetic, which I always think is really fun, and just like, you know, I don't know.
And the fact that those locations were real, it didn't feel like, you know, okay, here's the thing. I love Stranger Things. Like, I will defend it till, like, you know, till it gives me a reason to not defend it. But there are certain sets that do feel a little...
like a set?
Like a set.
Yeah.
You know? And while they did a pretty good job of their mall, it still wasn't perfect, you know? The Starcourt Mall. But like, the fact that they actually filmed this at a mall is,
yeah,
you know, in like the era of which it is supposed to take place,
yeah,
is perfect.
That's the thing, is I've never seen Stranger Things, but uh-oh, I imagine that it's hard for them, because obviously you go to a mall now, it's not going to look anything like it did in the 80s. So they can't just like go on location.
Part, no, I mean, you can. There are a lot of dead malls out there that are still very dated. And luckily Stranger Things has got that Stranger Things money now, so they can film that. But I'm sure it's, you know, if they have to destroy it, then it's easier to just build a set.
Yeah, probably.
So, you know, and that's just like kind of like the one property popping up. It's not really a great property for me, because they actually do a really fucking good job. Like, it does do a feel like a really good job. But like, probably like the Goldbergs, you know, like a sitcom, you know, that's supposed to be in the 80s and stuff, where you're just like, oh, that's hard, because they need like fast turnaround times and, you know, for making a sitcom and stuff. So I don't know. I've never seen an episode of it, but I like the fact that like that shot out of the galaxy is actually one of my favorite shots, because the galaxy no longer exists. And I loved it so much. It only existed for just over a decade. It was demolished in 2003. So I was only able to really enjoy it for like the first few, like 5 years, because it was basically destroyed by the time I was 21. And I was going to clubs since I was 18, so, and like hanging out in Hollywood like at the age of 18, so I really got it, like, I got to appreciate it in its like last heydays.
Okay.
And just the fact, you know, because like that external escalator, like, that's such a California image, you know.
Yeah, of, like, the, oh, weather. My gosh, yeah, it, like, really
only,
is
only us and like Miami can kind of like get away with that, you know. And I just think, like, oh, that's so brilliant, you know. I'm really glad that like there's a film out there that has, you know, has preserved it and like,
yeah,
let it be immortal in that way. So yeah, I appreciate that a lot. I think the characterization is really good of like the main cast. Like, I really adore Pike. I think he's very sweet. He's not like your typical anti-hero, you know, he, you know, like with a chip on his shoulder. He's actually very earnest and very nice. Does come off as having a little bit of a chip, but then like you realize it's really more Benny who's kind of a bad influence, or like kind of like more like the Joker, you know, like he's kind of the one who's like a little bit more raunch or whatever, but Pike himself is actually like not a bad guy.
Yeah,
and
no.
Even like the boyfriend, Jeffrey, like, he's just an idiot teenage boy. He's not like bad. He's just, you know, not, he's just like he's nothing. He's just a nothing character.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I really like it. I really like this film. Would you recommend it to anybody?
I mean, yeah, I think that it's fun. I think if you want a fun, campy vampire film, it's definitely worth watching. I think if you're a fan of the show and you've never seen it, it's definitely interesting to kind of see where it started. It's obviously very different than the Buffy you know, but like it's still, I mean, it definitely has those seeds and you can definitely see where the show came from based on that very clearly. And I mean, if you just want like a fun little 90s movie, like, yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah, same. All right. And with that, we have been Vampires Ruined My Life.
We have been.
I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. We have an ending.
That's okay. Thanks for listening. If you've seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie, let us know what you think. If you decided to watch it based on this episode, please let us know how you enjoy it. And if you're a fan of the show and you ever want to chat about it, I have lots of thoughts and feelings, so you can always hit me up.
This is Tori and Chell wishing you a fantabulous evening with vampire wishes and batty nightmares.
This podcast was edited by me, Tori. Our music is edited and mixed by Vikra the Never Living and includes Dark Halloween Night by Chase Allen Willis and Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Kevin MacLeod.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you really want to join our hellish crusade, please leave us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Be sure to tell your favorite blood-sucking fiends about Vampires Ruined My Life.